Coffee with a Coastie is brought to you by On the Coast Publications, the publishing house for On the Coast families and On the Coast over 55 community magazines on the central coast of New South Wales. Welcome to Coffee with a Coastie. Today I have the pleasure of sitting down with one of the coast's most beloved entertainers, Tony Stevens. Tony has travelled the world as a professional entertainer, though chose to call Australia home in 1972. With a career spanning decades, the list of talented individuals that Tony has worked with are endless, and a heart for giving back is evident in the work she does with charitable organisations and in the establishment of the Australian Ladies Variety Association. Being described as a one-woman party and a truly great entertainer who shows no signs of slowing down, it is with great pleasure that I get to say, welcome, Tony.
Hello, nice to meet you.
You too, Tony.
Yeah.
Thank you for your time today.
That's all right. Got plenty of it these days.
Although you sound like you keep reasonably busy.
Oh, yeah. I use most of my time, but there's plenty of time to use.
Yeah. Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
When reading about your life, It sounds like it has been full of adventure at every turn. Though it was in 1964, after appearing on a show called Opportunity Knocks, that you became a professional entertainer. Can you share some of your most memorable moments from these early years?
Obviously from the time I did earlier on in the piece, when at the time I did the shows with my dad, he was an entertainer, and my uncle was an entertainer, and we would do, or started off with charity shows in nursing homes, hospitals, and retirement villages, and also the prison, Windsor Green Prison. I remember doing that for the prisoners there, and they were a very good audience. They didn't see too many ladies, but I think the most memorable one that I had was not long after I turned professional. In December 1964, I went for an interview, an audition, to Manchester to entertain the American troops in Germany, and. I've met so many people over there. One of the particular people, a double act that we picked up in the minibus one time from Frankfurt and then delivered them to their show. And they were called Pat and Olivia. All right. And later on, that Olivia became Olivia Newton-John.
Wow.
You know, so that was way before that, all her fame. But the most memorable thing that I can remember is that on one of those tours to Germany, to Europe, I was sent on a train. I think it was probably lunchtime, mid-afternoon, and then overnight on a train to Rome on the way to instead of flying us down there, they sent us on a train because it was the cheapest, obviously, to Rome, and then from there fly to Libya. In North Africa, to Tripoli. And the agent said to us, pick up your visas in Rome. When we got to Rome, it was a bank holiday. It was a public holiday. So we couldn't get into the immigration department. So we rang up the agent and he said, just carry on and they'll organise your visa when you get there. Well, we landed there about 9 o'clock at night. It was dark. And the immigration people there wouldn't let us in because we didn't have visas. We had to wait at the airport overnight until the king of Libya, King Idris, got out of bed and signed the papers to let us in. So we were working at the Wheelers Air Base in Tripoli, and it's the first time I'd ever been exposed to cockroaches. They were an inch high. The ones here would, you know, they're miniature in comparison.
Yeah.
I think that's probably one of the most memorable things that I can remember, you know, shall we say adverse things. Another thing that happened there as well is that the agent didn't send us any money. So we didn't have any money to buy food with. So I remember going, when American troops like you, they'll throw coins onto the stage, you know, quarters and whatever. And very few dollars, but quarters. And I remembered when we didn't get the money in, I had to go into the club that I was on the night before. And hopefully the cleaners hadn't been in and picked the coins up. So I was able to get lunch. It was an experience, and but you know, all those experiences that we had were life, you know, curves. You know, life learning curves.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you just it's just it wasn't all plain sailing, shall we put it that way?
Nah, doesn't sound like it. And I can't imagine you'd get through. They'd say, "Oh, don't worry about it in Rome anymore."
What's that?
I can't imagine they'd be like that now, saying, "Oh, don't worry about
Yeah,
visa or whatever it is. We'll work that out later."
Very flimsy in those days. Yeah, absolutely.
That's probably the days when you could walk through and have a look, sit in the cockpit, and all that sort of stuff. Those days are gone.
Yeah.
You were born in 1944 in the UK, and you celebrated being in Australia for 50 years last year in 2022.
Mm-hmm.
Before arriving in Australia, you travelled the world performing in the UK, Germany, France, Libya, as you mentioned, South Africa, to name a few places. What is it that triggered the decision to board the SS Elenis,
yeah.
And arrive in Melbourne, Australia on the 14th of November, 1972?
Okay. I left Southampton on the 19th of May, 1972, to see the world, because I was going around in circles. In England, you know, you basically did the same club, the same month, same of each year.
Mm.
So you're just going around in circles. So I thought, spread your wings, go and have a look at the world, see what's there. So, you know, I had nothing to go to. I had absolutely no work to go to. So I got in touch with P&O. And I said, I want to go to South Africa. So they put me on without auditioning me. They charged me £40 just in case I wasn't any good. and that was my food. And they put me right at the very back of the ship on the last one, right next to the engine room at the back.
Yeah.
And I was well received. Then I got to South Africa and worked. I got in touch with an agent that there's a newspaper in England, a theatrical newspaper called The Stage, right? And always on the back of The Stage, there was this sort of, in the little columns at the back, you know, advertising, was just this little tiny little square with a guy called Hugo Coletti, and he was an agent in Johannesburg. So I cut that out and just... to be, you know, to sort of be on the safe side, at least I could possibly ring him. Anyway, I was introduced to, first of all, to the Mayfair Hotel in Durban. We stopped off in Cape Town overnight, and I went to one of the shows there and introduced myself to the entertainers there. I'll talk to the guy at the Mayfair Hotel in Durban. And anyway, so I did, and he put me up. You know, I had accommodation on the promise that I would come back and do a show for them. Anyway, and then I rang up Hugo Coletti, and he sent me to Rhodesia, as it was then, Zimbabwe now. I worked in this little sleazy little nightclub for 2 weeks in Rhodesia, then came back to Durban. And to Durban and did the Mayfair Hotel. Then I went across to Cape Town, did the Mount Nelson Hotel, which is a 5-star hotel, then. And then back to Johannesburg. And by about 4 months, I'd had enough. By the time I got back to Johannesburg, I wanted to continue on. So I called Chandra's Lines in London. They were the ones that did the £10 tourist boats, you know. And they're the ones that sent... the Elenis, the Chandra's, that's Onassis. That's the Onassis. Onassis was the owner of Chandra's.
Oh, yeah.
And the husband, second husband of Jackie Kennedy, the President Kennedy. She married. She then became Jackie Onassis.
Yeah.
So she married well.
Yeah.
Although he's probably old enough to be her grandfather. But anyway, so they put me on to the Elenis at Cape Town. And that was the 30th of October, I think, in 1972. And then landed. We didn't stop another one. I think we went straight across the Indian Ocean. We went to Perth. Now, Chandra's never had fresh milk on board. they only had condensed milk in cans.
That's sweet.
That's horrible in your tea. Awful. And so I fought my way to the front of the queue and I drank about 3 pints of fresh milk straight out of the where they were making milkshakes. And anyway, so then it had been my ambition to sail into Sydney Harbour. But by the time I get to Melbourne, I just about had enough because I was terribly seasick. And one of the things I still see it in my mind now, as someone coming from England, and 14th of November, we stopped off in Adelaide, and I went down to the main shopping street, and to see Santa on top of one of these stores,
yeah.
huge Santa with tinsel glittering in the sunlight and blue skies, you know, because it's summer.
That's right.
And that was like, hang on, that's not right.
Well, it's supposed to be
snow. And with the blue skies above it and Santa glittering all, you know, it was weird. It was just weird, but it was something that you never forget. It's like a photograph in your mind.
Yeah.
And then when I got to Melbourne, I had made a lot of friends on that first trip to Durban with the Women's Weekly World Cruise. That was what they sent me out of Southampton on the Himalaya. And so they were all saying, come and see us, come and visit us. And so I ended up getting off in Melbourne and staying with friends there. And I was there from the 14th of May to November. And I was there till March. And in the meantime, I worked on Melbourne Television.
Yeah.
I worked at the telethon that they'd put on, and in a couple of the nightclubs there. So you know, I sort of managed to survive until March, I lived where I was living with my friends. I was living not far from Channel 10, so I decided, and it was only a walk across the field to Channel 10.
Yeah,
and. I went on a game show with a lady called Pat McDonald and Gary, I can't remember his name, he was an American. Anyway, I won £60, $60, and I was the carryover champion. It was like what's that game that where you, three words, and like a, you know that party game. You got a book. It's a book or a film, a movie.
Charades.
Charades. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was that kind of a game show. So I was
one of the ones where you wear the name on your head something. Was it?
No. It's you've got. I can't remember exactly how it went, but anyway, so I won £60, and by then I'd got myself with the money I'd saved up in South Africa. I'd bought myself a car, and so I set out to go to Sydney. And I'm thinking to myself, this is a hell of a long road in comparison with what we had in England. It's the first time I'd ever driven along that road, you know, that length of road.
With nothing probably on either side of the road for a fair bit of time.
Yeah, I mean, in those days you didn't have motorways.
Mm.
You were going through down the Hume Highway, literally down the Hume Highway.
Mm-hmm.
And I did actually peel off a little while, go and visit my ex-fiance a long time ago, who now lived in Canberra, so worked with the government out there. So I went to visit him for a few days and then carried on to Sydney. And when I got to Sydney, I had nothing. I had nowhere to stay, basically. So I stayed at a hotel in what I called in those days Coogee. In Coogee.
Coogee.
Yeah. And
you would have found plenty of English.
Well, I stayed in this hotel and then I put an ad in the paper that, you know, looking for digs, as we call them in England. Oh, dear, I got some weird phone calls, I can tell you. Was I into Troy, whatever the trios and things like that?
Yeah.
No. I was just wanting somewhere to stay.
Yeah.
Anyway. Eventually, I ended up meeting another old, well, I actually hadn't met him, but I was introduced to him by an agent friend in Nottingham who lived in Eastwood, and he was part of a double act called what's the double act? I can't remember the. Hang on, I'll think about it when I'm not thinking about it.
Yeah.
And Ken Morriston, his name was, and so he ended up inviting me because he was in his house on his own, and he said, "Look, it's a big house. Oh, you can have that end of the house. I'll have this end of the house." So it was no sort of romantic of things or anything, he was a very kind man, very kind of very, very what's the word? He was very crafty. I don't mean crafty as in he built all his own furniture. He was a good woodworker and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I stayed there for quite a few months, and then I had to go. Then I went back to England, via New Zealand and Hawaii, and because I was
actually left Australia and went back to England at some point.
I was originally only just going to go around the world.
Yeah,
I had no intentions of staying in Australia, but once I got here, and I went to this agent's office, he wasn't there. The one from Melbourne, I was recommended to this agent in Sydney.
Yeah.
So he wasn't there. But in the next office was another guy who was trying to organise a charity night. Mm. And he called me in and introduced himself. Wally Reitman, his name was. And he got a phone call while I was sitting there from this guy who was supposed to do this charity thing the following night. And he couldn't make it. And he said, "What do you mean you can't make it?" He said, "You know, it's all booked in." And I just went. I literally went, "I'll do it."
You went, "Thumbs up, thumbs I've got up, it.
I'll do it." Yeah. So it saved his bacon.
Yeah.
Whether he didn't know whether I was any good or not.
Yeah.
But the point is, I was a comedian. Yeah. And that's what made the difference. There was only one comedian in those days to talk of, and her name was Jan Adele. And your people that are probably reading this or listening to this will remember Jan Adele. She worked with a guy called many years for a guy called Lucky Grills, and they were always on the television.
Yeah.
And she was the only one, and I sort of came in and sort of stole her thunder. A little bit younger than she was, and just different. Totally different, because I worked very clean, you know, and she worked a little bit risque. In fact, very risque.
Yeah.
So, it was good fun. And within a few weeks after that show, because there were quite a few agents in there, I was the new kid on the block and getting all the work that I needed, three up to five shows a week.
Yeah.
So started making good money, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. That's like, as you mentioned, from the moment you arrived in Australia, things sound like they fell into place.
Yeah.
From people you met on the ship to exactly as you just mentioned, the first talent agent wasn't there, and so you went into another office and you got a job.
Yeah.
What other bits of your journey at the beginning there? So I know you said you travelled to Sydney. What instigated the travel to Sydney?
Oh, just keep going.
Yeah,
you know, keep on going. You don't sort of stay in one place too long.
Yeah.
If I go to visit somewhere, and this is not just then, but even now, I will go maybe not for 3 or 4 days. I might go for 2 days and do as much stuff in 2 days as I would have done in 3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
Because I can come back. If I've got it recorded, I can come back and I can go over those.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when I'm going to Chiang Mai this very shortly to see a friend. To see a friend's son. The last time I was in Chiang Mai, for $100, I got a car, air conditioned, a driver, and a guide, and I did in 1.5 days what I would have taken me almost a week to do.
Yeah,
you know. That's what I like to do. I don't like to linger in places for too long. Yeah.
Yeah, I must admit, my wife and I've travelled a bit like that, actually.
Yes, well, you get bored. I get bored. I've been there, done that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, you were one of only two comedians.
We're called comedians now.
Yeah.
We're called comedians. In fact, somebody said to me the other day, "What do you do for a living?" I said, "I'm a comedian." He said, "No, you're not." I said, "Yes, I am. I'm a comedian." He said, "Well, go on then, change colour."
I didn't get it.
You didn't get it. Oh, you poor young fella.
I know.
That's a chameleon, changes colour.
Chameleon, that's right.
Well, there you go. I was a chameleon.
He thinks he's a chameleon. Oh, jeez. Oh, I know a chameleon. In fact, that's it. All right. That didn't go, yeah.
Over your dear little head.
It did. Mm-hmm. But your first performance as a comedian, was for a male stag night that you said you were nervous, though it must have gone down okay, as you couldn't remember it being a flop.
Mm-hmm.
As you always remember those.
Yeah.
Now they say that you learn the most when things don't go as planned. So I wondered, what is a flop that you remember, and what is it that you learned the most from it?
Well, first of all, in England, I remember.
Not that you'd have any flops. But
no, well, as I said, I worked very clean.
Yeah.
Because even though my mother and my dad were 3.5 hours, 4 hours away, I was worried that they would find out that I was doing naughty jokes.
Yeah.
So I would never, ever, right? So I was in a place called Sunderland, which is up near Newcastle in the north of England.
Yeah.
Right? And I'd worked it a few times, but this one particular club, they call the secretary manager, came in and he did what they call, after my first spot, usually do two spots or up to four spots, depending if you're in between the bingo, you know.
Yeah.
And he paid, what they call paid me off. In other words, he gives you half your fee and then says, go away. and he said, you've got to be more rude, you know, and can I say what I like on here? Because
you
said, we had such and such.
We can edit it later if we don't like it.
we had such and such here last week, another lady, comedian, and she called the organist Spotty Bum. you got to be more rude. You got to be more near the knuckle. I said, well, I couldn't do that. Couldn't be like that. So, and that's why I stopped doing in Australia men shows. Because they expected you to be blue, and I don't work blue.
Yeah.
No. And the only other time I can remember that I was, it was this, that didn't go down well, was hearing, actually in Curry, where I was booked to do a bowling club presentation. Now, to me, bowling clubs are seniors, people. They wear the nice jackets when they have the presentations and, you know, nice trousers and, you know, ties and everything. And I got there and it was the first time I ever worked using backing tracks. And I was frustrated with these backing tracks and I couldn't get my head around it. But I was absolutely appalled when these young boys were coming up in bonds, shorts,
yeah,
and thongs to get be presented. So they'd opened it up to all and sundry. Mm. And I only accepted the job because I thought I was going to be working to mature people. There's no way in the world I would have been working. Eventually they actually went out and said, they gone, have they? They said, yeah, because they were really annoyed with them as well. So we got on all right after that, but it wasn't a show that I would like to repeat.
So yeah. I think I take from that, from what...
But you learn, I mean...
From what you learn is that you learn to stick to your guns of what you think is ethically right and what you think is what you are, actually, from
that's
the two things you've just brought up.
No,
it's not, they didn't considerably go bad. They were just... You had to stick to your guns and go, no, this is who I am. This is what I do. This is...
That's what I said to the agents here. I said, look, if you're expecting me to do anything other than my normal act...
Yeah.
Don't book me. That was the rules. And these days, the same thing. Not that I'm doing anything anymore, basically, I won't work with food. I won't work. If you're going to serve food, I will. either just go singing, or, you know, they will, if they bring any food out while I'm on stage, because you cannot work with food or kids.
So, yeah, well, I thought you were going to say kids and dogs or kids and pets or something like that.
No, food, because one...
Food wasn't exactly what I was thinking you were going to say.
No, because one time, because I make people laugh, right?
Yeah.
Now, can you imagine somebody having
wearing it.
An apple pie and I make them laugh and she chokes on it? And the
paramedics
had to come in.
That make, did it?
Mm-hmm.
Someone actually, paramedics had to come in?
She was choking. And that's why I said, I won't work with food. If you read my instructions on all of my, like for Davistown and for 1G, the instructions are no staff allowed on the floor whilst the show is in progress.
So you do shows that have meals?
Yeah, I do theatre restaurant.
You do theatre. So how does that work?
I specialise in theatre restaurant.
Yeah, so that's mean. Well, they come in at food, but you do theatre restaurant.
They come in at 11 o'clock.
Yeah,
and they have morning tea.
Yeah,
right. I actually start working to them out in the bar, you know, and I'm yelling, you know, bringing them all in because I've got loads of bus groups. Yep. Which I've built up over years, many years. And then I bring them in, they have their morning tea. Then I do a welcome segment, which goes about 15 minutes. Then they have their main course. Then I go back on again, do 5 minutes and introduce the guest artist, the star of the show, right, which now I'm able to do. In there, I was never able to do it. Because it wasn't big enough. I had to do the show myself.
You're saying in the old bakehouse.
Yeah. Which you'll see, yeah.
Yeah.
And then after they finished, if that's 1:45, they get their desserts. And at 2:15, basically they can think about leaving.
Then yeah.
That's theatre restaurant. It's food, show. I learned all about that back in the 80s with a guy called Frank Baden-Powell that owns Sydney Theatre Restaurants, Dirty Dicks, Roman Scandals, Beachcomber Island, and I forget what the other one is. That was Dirty Dicks. He had 4 at one stage.
Yeah.
Anyway,
There you go. Yeah. That's interesting. Mm. Having worked with some talented and amazing people in the entertainment industry, who is it that's been the most memorable and why?
Most memorable was Dame Vera Lynn, who I actually didn't work with as such, but she was the most memorable person. She was the one I got closer to than anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a whole load on the website of people that I've worked with.
Yeah. What makes Dame Vera?
Well, because she was just such a high-profile lady. I mean, she was so, the 100 years, the whole of Britain celebrated 100 years anniversary. It was written on the White Cliffs of Dover.
Yeah,
you know, she was, and yet she would welcome me into her home. I've helped her to eat her food, cut her food up for her when she was, you know, pretty old and stuff like that. That's her up there. Looks at the back of me, at the back. Yeah, and.
A lovely big picture of her.
Yeah, and quite a few. There's a few others that have...
Basically, she's gone above and beyond.
Oh, yeah.
And stuff. That...
Yeah, I mean, always. It was quite a few years after I first met her and when she stopped coming to Australia.
Yeah.
But I was so thrilled when I wrote to her and said, love to pop in and see you. Yeah. And she said, come anytime. You're welcome, you know.
Yeah.
And she always made me feel well. Her daughter would pick me up at the station.
Yeah.
Drop me back home. In fact, I'm going to be seeing her daughter again shortly. Vera died at 103.
Wow.
And so you've obviously looked up her profile on there. And I was so honoured. When she died in 2001, in June, of course, mid-COVID, and it was a very small family funeral.
It wasn't 2001 then.
No, 2008. 21.
Yeah.
She died in June, and it was just a family. That's all that was there.
Yeah, unfortunately.
A lot of people lined the streets. I was quite surprised when I saw that on television.
Mm.
You know, like a royal funeral. But then last year, it had taken a month to get here. I received an invitation from the Dean of Westminster and the family of Dame Vera Lynn to join them to celebrate her life and work at Westminster Abbey in London. And that was on the 9th, on the 17th of March, I was on a plane.
Yeah.
I received the invitation. My kid says, "You're not going to miss that, Mum.
No.
You're not going to miss that." And they got on there and booked me premium economy. Cost me a bloody fortune. But anyway, it was an experience I'd never forget. I actually sat like no more than 6 feet to where the Queen would have sat.
Yeah.
To you know, with all the weddings and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Just to the left there.
Yeah.
She would have sat there.
I mean, quite the experience.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It was just amazing. I was just so honoured to be thought of, you know, because, you know, as I said, my liaison was with her, not so much with
family.
The family, yeah. And it was...
You were obviously spoken about.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know whether they sent it to me, just thinking I wouldn't make it. But I did.
She turned up.
I did. Oh, my God, she turned up, yes.
No, anyway, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Is there anyone you've drawn influence from throughout your career, and in what way have they influenced you?
Well, this is a question I could answer two ways. First of all...
You're allowed to answer it two ways.
Two ways. First of all, when I was at school, the first person that influenced me, I played guitar, right? I got a guitar. Actually, there was going back a little way, there was a girl above me, 2 years in after my school, who played the guitar, and she was always on the television. Beautiful, very, you know, tall, slim, black curly hair, and she was just wonderful. And I went home to my mum because I couldn't take to the guitar. I couldn't take to the piano. My dad played the piano and the accordion. Couldn't take to any of those. And I said to my mum and dad, I said, "Anne Bridgman got a guitar. I want a guitar for Christmas." So they bought me a little guitar for Christmas. And I learned off the television from a guy called Bert Whedon, just the basic chords. And when I went, we were having a Christmas school party, and Anne was playing on stage. And I went up to her and I said, "I've got a guitar. I'm going to be just like you." And she said to me, "You keep practicing, love." And I did, and I kept on. And the weird thing is that going on, obviously she was 2 years ahead of me, so obviously she left well before me. Mm. And years and years later, when I'm here in Australia in Ryde with a second-hand furniture shop and antique shop in Ryde, just behind the Civic Centre, my husband's assistant, he was out, husband's assistant called me through because I did all the renovations inside the house. And he said, "How much is this?" She said, "How much is this table outside the office?" I said, "I think it's $35. And she said, "Oh, it's not the one that was here last week." Oh, so he must have brought another one in the meantime. Mm. Sold that one and brought the other one in. And then I used to go to auctions. Loved auctions, and I learned how to tell what the timber was. Yeah. I went underneath there, pressing my nails into the timber to see if it was cedar, right? It was reddish colour because cedar's a reasonably soft timber. And as I'm going down like this, looking under the table, this head coming down with me. Now, we're talking Ryde, the other end of the world now,
that's
right?
That's right, yeah.
And she said, "I know you." I said, "I seem to know your face." She said, "Did you used to go to the British School of Commerce?" I said, "Yes." She said, "I'm Anne Bridgman."
Huh.
Now, if that table had been the same one, we would never have crossed paths. Right, but she'd gone from England to New Zealand, to where the parents lived. then back to Australia and lived only around the corner from where I was. That is amazing. It's just, that's part of my book that I'm writing under the on the heading 6 degrees of separation.
Yeah. That makes complete sense. What was your other one?
Oh, yes. Another lady that I used to, when we used to do those auditions in Manchester, one of the owners of the club there was called Lynn Rogers.
Yeah.
And she was an Australian. And we used to go after we'd done our shows, we'd go and watch the late show at the Piccadilly Club in Manchester with Lynn Rogers. And she was the one that taught us the presentation and the hands.
Presence.
The presence on stage. She was the one that influenced me as far as putting over a song properly, listening to the words, which young people don't do these days. And she now lives on the Gold Coast, and she's my dearest friend. And when she's in the audience and I'm working and I'm singing a song and I'm going, I'm telling her about the hands. I'm showing her the hands are working.
Holding your hands, positioning your hands. That's right, and working with your hands.
Yeah, that's right.
That's cool. It's amazing. The list of shows that you've done is endless. Mm-hmm. So if you had to pick one, what would be your most memorable and why?
I think the Argyle Tavern was the most memorable. First of all, like having learned all about Theatre Restaurant, I decided back in 1986, thereabouts, that I wouldn't mind putting a show on the harbour, So I created the Port Jackson Showboat. And the Port Jackson, of course, used to be the name of Sydney Harbour.
Yeah.
And, of course, Jackson, the word Jackson, I'm going to Jackson, It sort of conjures up things of the South.
Yeah.
So it was all southern stuff,
Yeah.
And so I had three entertainers and 3-piece band on this little boat, which wasn't a little boat. We could get 120 people on it.
It's not too small.
But it was open. It's open. Had a stage at the end of it.
Yeah.
And I believe it's now back. I believe it's up on now around the Port Macquarie area.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It was originally called the Richmond Riverboat.
Yeah.
And then it got called the Rocks Rhythm Boat.
Yeah.
It's RR, so. And then it was called the Sydney Fun Boat. But it was like a box. Literally like a box on water. But we were there from July the 4th. We opened on the 4th of July.
Yeah.
Born on the 4th of July. And we closed on a Christmas in 87. So it was 2.5 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and then from there on, I went to do the Argyle Tavern, which I ended up doing 7 nights a week for nearly 6 years.
Wow.
So, and commuting from here. So that took a huge.
Wow. Commuting from the coast.
Yeah.
To Argyle. Mm. 7 nights a week.
7 nights a week, yeah. Until I managed to find myself a double,
Stunt dummy that could stand in for
a
you.
Stand in. Yeah. But in actual fact, the way it works, we had every musician had a backup.
Yeah.
Two backups.
Yeah.
So we were able to put 3 shows on at the same time.
Yeah.
Every night. Sometimes they had people coming in from overseas.
Yeah.
Like big insurance companies that had won their trip to Australia.
Yeah.
So there might be 500 people.
Yeah.
So there'd be some in the Argyle, there'd be some in the Woolshed, there'd be some in the nightclub. So the 3 shows going. The original, at least one member of the original team was with each show. And then, so there wasn't too many people that knew how to play the didgeridoo there. So we had to work it out so that the one person or maybe 2 people did the didgeridoo. Anyway.
Oh, wow.
I think that's the most memorable because it's the longest show that I ever did made a lot of friends.
So how long did you say that went for?
Well, it went for actually over 6 years, but we went to 6 months in between.
Yeah.
So we were contracted for 2.5 years, 3 years, and then another 2.5 after that.
I've read that when required to, you can sing in six different languages.
Yes.
What languages can you sing in? Okay. And how did you come to be able to sing in so many different languages?
Well, when I say sing in the language, first of all, I know how to say hello.
Oh, yeah.
How are you? In many languages.
Yeah.
Not just when I was singing.
Yeah.
But the languages that I sing in are learned phonetically, right? Yeah. So if I'm learning a German song, for instance, this particular German song, I got my choreographer's husband, who's German. I said, Klaus, I want to learn that song. And I couldn't make it out what they were singing.
Mm.
Anyway, he wrote it all out, and we sat across the table, and I say, okay, tell me what the words are. So he would say them in German, but I would say, write them down as I heard him. Like the beautiful, for instance, Schöne, Schöne, right? For me, it became Sherna. Schöne. Do you know, see what I mean?
You can understand it, yeah.
But I have absolutely no idea what I'm singing about.
Oh, wow.
I sing the songs. Once they're in there, the languages that I sing in, obviously in German, in German.
With Klaus.
French, Spanish, Italian, Hebrew, Maori, and Japanese.
There you go.
And Australian, so that's...
Well, okay.
Yeah.
That's right. So are you classifying Australian and American as two different languages?
Now there's another one, Welsh.
All right.
Singing Welsh.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
You were the original founder in 1978 of ALVA, the Australian Ladies Variety Association, as you noticed a void in the industry for female entertainers. What's one of the proudest moments that you have achieved through the filmation of ALVA?
The fact that they've, for 40 odd years now, it was founded in 1978, right? And Dame B. Rilline actually was the original, you know, she was there at our original banquet. We have banquets in there. And the fact that it is now one of the most respected associations, charitable associations, within the variety industry in Australia, worth now about $4 million. And helping entertain the original idea was actually to provide accommodation for retired entertainers, but nobody wanted to go in it. They were too proud.
Not only they were too proud, but no one stops entertaining until they can't.
Well, look at what's happening now. Next week or 2 weeks from now, Lucky Star is the star of my show.
Yeah,
he's 82.
Yeah,
you know. Roland Storm has only just stopped. He's gone back to far north Queensland.
Yeah.
And he was a rocker of the 60s.
Yeah.
You know, and that none of them stop working. I mean, even though I'm not working full time,
yeah,
I'm still hosting my own shows and you know, doing all this stuff here, like booking everything, getting everything paid and all that. They all pay prior to.
Yeah.
It's like booking tickets for... It's not a turn up on the day thing.
No way.
They can't do that. But because we have to organize. In other words,
you
now.
You need to know how many people you're catering for.
The clubs don't. Because of the caterers, yeah. The clubs don't pay me. I pay them.
Yeah.
I pay them to do the catering for me.
Yeah.
But that's good for their members as well, though.
Yeah.
Because they don't have to fork out the money then for entertainment because it's there on their door. I've taken it to them.
It goes to show, though, too, that it's an amazing industry to be part of if everyone wants to continue to work until they can't work anymore.
That's right.
Do you know what I mean? Like it's that stands for something.
Yeah. It's as while they're still good.
Yeah.
I can't say that I agree that everybody should be in the industry. you do get some people who are not recognizing the fact. it's good though.
They're white knuckling it.
Hanging on. Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah. But as I said, ALVA is now 78. It's 45 years old now.
Yeah.
And it's just, I mean, everybody admires ALVA.
Yeah.
The Mo Awards have closed down now and they left their balance in their bank account to ALVA.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we're able to help with a lot of bills and of entertainment and other you, people.
You're still active within Alvar?
Not, I'm not really active because I'm too far away now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're all based in Sydney,
yeah,
southern Sydney, you know, yeah. So, you know, if they need me to do anything, I will do it. A lot yeah. of people reach out to me if they need help for some with something.
Yeah.
But there's only so much I can do.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know, so, yeah.
Yeah,
but
cool.
No, they still think me of me as Alva.
Yeah, yeah.
They bring
yeah.
me, you know, instead of the president.
That's yeah. right. And a lot of the research I did, I can see that still to be the case.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I read in your dear friend Kerry Dyer's book, mm-hmm. My Corner of the Sky,
yeah.
that your name used to be Christine McLean.
Yes.
How did you decide okay. to change your name?
Okay, 1964, after Opportunity Knocks.
Yeah.
I didn't win Opportunity Knocks, but my profile went up. And by Christmas of that...
So when you did Opportunity Knocks, you were Christian...
I was actually Christine Hill.
Christine. Oh,
Christine
right.
Hill, that's my maiden name.
Yeah.
And it came up on screen as Christine Hill.
Yeah.
Right? And by the time it's the end of 1964... I had Christine on the front of my guitar,
oh, yeah.
right, and on the back I had Guaranteed No Relation. Now that was because of a lady, a very notorious lady in England, again that your readers and your listeners will remember as Christine Keeler, who was the Monica Lewinsky of the 1970s or 60s, whatever it was.
Okay, yeah.
It was actually, there was a program on the Foxtel recently. A series,
yeah.
Christine Keeler case, and it was called The Profumo Affair. It was a guy called Profumo who absolutely denied having anything to do with her. But the funniest thing was she had an offsider called Mandy Rice Davis. And when I did my very first full week in Yorkshire, the second act on the bill, I say this, there was Bob Monkhouse was the main act, who was one of the best game show hosts ever. Bob Monkhouse, wonderful man. And the second on the bill was Mandy Rice Davis. So she had cashed in on her infamy, you know, and you know, and the fame. And she was actually did an act. She actually had an act. But God, she was a beautiful woman. She was I remember now seeing her on stage, she had this skin-coloured, fully beaded outfit. This is when fully beaded meant handmade, right? And she just stood there and she basically talked her way through an act. You know, we did what we call point numbers. In other words, the piano goes, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, right? So they're playing the chords,
yeah.
But she's simply talking the words.
Yeah.
Rex Harrison used to do that in My Fair Lady. He did that. How can a woman be like a man? You get the music in the background, which goes with the lyrics,
yeah.
But their actual lyrics are actually spoken rather than sung. And that's what she did.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there you go.
So, and then how did you end up with Tony?
Oh, Tony was the name of a lady... who had just married King Hussein of Jordan.
Yeah.
She was a telephonist. I thought she was in the British Army, actually. But she married King Hussein of Jordan. Her name was Tony Gardner. And so I thought, Tony, that's, you know. And then my friend in the office, my colleague in the office, her niece had just been called Tony. Then Stevens was the name of my boyfriend at the time. So Tony Stevens, and I wrote it a few times. It flowed. So there you go. Tony Stevens was born.
There
you go. Christine McLean. So it does confuse the taxman terribly, but you know, we won't worry about that.
Yeah, yeah.
They know
flying under the radar.
They know all my names. They know all my names.
Yeah. Another name that you are synonymous with is Auntie Molly.
That's me.
I wondered, who is Auntie Molly and how did Auntie Molly's Entertainment come about?
Well, first of all, it was the Bakehouse. I mean, it's Auntie Molly came afterwards. When we moved up from Sydney to Currumbong, we brought some of the furniture from the antique shop. and it was stored in the shed. We bought a 10-acre property out of Currumbong. It was stored in the shed there because it was too good to leave behind. And the people that, you know, it was too good to sell cheap. So, and, you know, I had bought some really nice pieces up. And so we ended up finding the bakehouse, which was a total derelict place, this place.
Yeah.
It was totally derelict. And my husband came up and we moved a lot of the furniture. And I used to go to Sydney, and because I still loved auctions. Yeah. So we used to be with a van and pick up stuff from Sydney. And he used to go out and get estate for, like, people's, when they passed away, he would clear people's houses out, you know, which is not what everybody does. A lot of furniture dealers would go in there and say, I'll have that, and that. And, yeah, but Jim would go and do the whole lot. And then he... I met in the shop. I was still working at the Argyle Tavern at the time, and when I managed to get someone to stand in for me quite a few months, I thought, well, you know, maybe we can do something entertain-wise in here. And so somebody asked me, could I do a morning tea for a bus group? And I thought, because we had a little cafe. It was Auntie Molly's tea shop at the old bakehouse. There was a little cafe. There's six tables, 24 chairs, and that was it. They, could you do a morning tea? And I said, why not? So we got all the tables and chairs together we could find, borrowed some from over the road from the Masonic Hall, and put together... this for about 40 people, we supplied a morning tea for a bus group. And then somebody says, could you do a lunch for a bus group? I thought, why not?
Yeah.
So we, so again, we did the same, basically the same thing. And we had the electrical power upgraded to three phase so that we could plug in bain-maries. So then I would cook in my kitchen in there, and then take everything over. I did everything myself.
Yeah.
I would go on stage with pumpkin under my fingernails. And so we did that. And then I thought, there's a niche here. There's people are looking for places to go. And I was down in Lake Haven in the shopping centre there, and I met an old piano player. He'd been retired for ages. And I said, Joe, I said, are you interested to do a show, you know, up at Auntie Molly's at my place? Oh, yeah, you know, the odd one or two, he thought. Yeah. Anyway, I think we started off with St. Patrick's. We started off with a St. Patrick's theme.
Makes sense.
And then we did we started doing some nighttime shows. And then I started promoting it via Probus clubs. And I've got, like, not... all Probus clubs, but nearly 2,000 on my mailing list now. Yeah. So when I send something out, it goes, and that goes out to nearly 2,000, including umpteen bus companies, Probus clubs, view clubs, you name it. It's bowling clubs, you know, and so then, but unfortunately, we could only hold 68 people in there, right? So we did normal meals at other times.
Yeah.
But when we had a show on, then we had to move everything around. So it was when I decided to stop doing the catering in there and leasing it out to other people, the first lot were okay, but the Italians, we had some Italians in there, and they didn't want to do the lunchtime thing. Yeah. They didn't want to do it. They had Italian. They had no idea how to cook a roast anyway.
Oh,
you know? It's all pasta and stuff to them.
Yeah, right. Good pizza and pasta, though, no doubt.
Yeah. Oh, well, should imagine so, but not for not for seniors when they were promised a roast lunch.
Yeah.
And then so... eventually I sort of decided to move it, and I looked around and I ended up at Wyong Golf Club.
Yeah.
Where I could only get 68 people in here.
Yeah.
So some of the bus groups came in with two buses. They either had to split the days.
Yeah.
You know, they had to come Wednesday and Thursday, or they had, you know, they anyway, so but I could get 168 people in there. And then from then on, then I started booking other people, like other Lucky Star, Joey Fermano,
yeah.
Danny Elliott. I mean, if you look on the website, there's you'll plenty. See most of the people yeah. that I've used yeah. over the years. And so it's, and then I think it was 2 or 3 years that I was.
And did it always operate as Auntie Molly's from the
Auntie
moment?
Molly's Seniors Entertainment Events.
Yeah.
This stayed as the old Bakehouse.
Yeah.
But it ended up with Auntie Molly's Seniors Entertainment Events. So it's
it's grown to what it is.
It's grown to what it is now. But they went into renovation, couldn't tell me when they were coming out of it.
Yeah.
So I looked for other venue. I ended up with two. I ended up with 1G Workers, a club in Davistown, RSL.
Yeah.
And both of them greeted me with open arms because they had no entertainment on, you know, yeah. as like for seniors.
Yeah.
It means it was all put on a plate for them, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
that's amazing.
Yeah.
You've done and continue to do so much for charity. What is it that drives you to continue to help others?
Abraham Lincoln said, "When I do good, I feel good." And I've always maintained that despite the fact that over the years I've been paid to do jobs, I never enjoy anything more than when I'm doing something for somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know I'm making somebody else's life better. I've done for nearly almost every charity you can think of.
Yeah,
put on big shows and stuff like that. John Paul Young's been with me, Marty Roan, Lucky Star, Little Patty, Sandy Scott. I mean, these are people you were probably in the old
I
days.
I know that I've read their names because I've read your website.
Yeah, that's right. And it's just that I do enjoy doing things for other people.
Yeah.
You know, just it's just the way I started out.
Yeah.
And I think
because I know you did charity work with your father and uncle in jails
yeah.
or something.
Yeah. I think it's the appreciation you get.
Yeah.
When you're doing something, when they're paying you, they go, "You're paying." You know.
I spoke to someone recently, and they were talking about. They're motivational. They do a lot of motivational, inspirational
yeah.
Events. And they said something about, you know, picking someone else up mm-hmm. is where you get the greatest reward.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Rather than picking your
yeah, yeah. I've done things for individuals. Not that I like doing things for individuals because just of an experience that I had
yeah.
with one thing. I'm just doing one now because I'm with Rotary. I'm yeah. actually the incoming president of the Rotary Club of Warners Bay. So yeah. I'm actually the president elect.
Yeah.
So in September this year, I'm going to put on a show at Warners Bay Theatre, what do they call it? Performing Arts Theatre,
mm-hmm.
For Rotary Health Foundation. Australian Rotary Health is called ARH.
Yeah.
Australian Rotary Health. They're the biggest funders of research for mental health. So that's, you know, that's an important thing.
I think so.
And also it's a reasonable amount of money where people pay $50 to come to my things.
Yeah.
But that includes morning tea and it includes the lunch, it includes the show.
Yeah.
Whereas this will include morning tea. And the show.
Yeah.
So they're only paying $25.
Yeah.
Which on top of their bus fare then is quite a reasonable amount.
I reckon.
And all the money goes, everything, I don't take a thing out of that, nothing. All the money goes to the Rotary Health via my club, which is Warners Bay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's, as I said, it's just something I enjoy doing I enjoy it. It's more rewarding.
Yeah.
You know, it's more rewarding. Yeah.
Yeah. finally, I've read that you said you believe that everything we do in life, whether good or not so good, is a learning curve.
Yeah.
So I'd like to ask you your life advice on navigating the good or not so good, and if you could share anything you have personally learned along the way that we could all benefit from.
Okay. When I'm selling raffle tickets, I say, you never know if you never have a go. You got to be in it to win it. You never know if you never have a go. And that's been my policy. I never think about things too much. I'll give it a... If someone said to me, can you do this? Like I said, why not?
Yeah.
Can you do this? I said, why not? If it works, fine. If it doesn't, you've learned something from it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? One of my other favourite little quirks is every time someone asks you, and if you think it's doable, obviously,
yeah,
you give it a go. Because somebody said to me, if you ask to take on a job that you don't think you can do, take it on and then learn about it afterwards.
That's like this podcast.
It's a bit like marriage. And the other thing that I always say is, whenever they ask you to do it, say why not.
Yeah.
So four words, why not? Because at the end of your, when you fall off your perch, the end of your life, they can't put on your epitaph, what if?
Yeah.
See what I mean? Say why not? Because you don't know what's going to come, and they can't say whether it will be, and you won't know unless you give it a go. Mm-hmm. That's it. And that's been my policy all along.
It does sound like it, especially when I've read all about your life. You've gone all in.
The time I left England and had nothing to go to.
That's right.
I had nowhere to. What was I going to do when I got there if I couldn't get anything?
And as you said, even driving from Melbourne to Sydney, nothing to go to.
I know.
Going to a hotel. I can't even fathom. Like, that just doesn't even.
What's that?
My life, having just, like, for myself, just going, oh, no, I'm going to go to Sydney. I don't know. I'm going to rent a hotel room until I work out.
Yeah, you get there and you work it out.
Yeah, it's just amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Tony, thank you very much for your time today.
You're welcome.
If anyone would like to find out more about Tony and go and watch her perform at Wanji District Workers Club or Davistown RSL, go to arniemollys.com.au or simply search Tony Stevens for more information.
No, simply search Auntie Molly's.
Or search Auntie Molly's.
Yes.
You'll find...
Because you go to the website.
Yeah.
If you search Tony Stevens, there's quite a few in the world, you know.
There is,
When
I searched Tony Stevens, I can tell you, it took me straight to you. You were like...
Top of the list.
You were at the top of the list.
Oh, wow.
So maybe geographically it knows you are the Tony Stevens I'm
looking for. I remember once I Googled myself and I came up with a lady, and I stayed in touch with her for a little while, called Tony Stevens, and she was in the Falkland Islands.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, very
so
good.
There you go. That's good. Perfect. Yeah.
Well, thanks, Tony.
You're welcome. You're very
wonderful.
Welcome.
Wonderful. Thanks.
Excellent. That's jolly good.
Coffee with a Coastie is brought to you by On the Coast Publications, the publishing house for On the Coast families and On the Coast over 55 community magazines on the Central Coast of New South Wales.